So let's pray this morning, and we'll get into this morning's Sunday school lesson. Our Father, I pray your blessing upon us. Thank you for these dear saints and for their dedication and service. And I pray, Lord, that you would help us to be growing in grace and understanding and knowledge. And of course, that will then be reflected in the way we live. And we pray that all these things would be to your glory in Jesus' name. Amen. So we've given a few weeks now, not really an extended amount of time, but I'm gonna do two more weeks is my plan. Today, the 27th, the 3rd, and the 10th, and then we'll be done with this for Sunday school, just talking about the Christian and God's money. And so we've talked about some of the basic principles about giving. Last Sunday school time, we talked about giving in the Old Testament. And so just a little bit of a preview. Next Sunday, I'm going to talk specifically about the tithe, because that always becomes kind of the hot button issue. And then the week after that, the 10th, I'm going to talk to us about a little bit of the time about kind of how we process your offerings here at Westwood Heights, because I think that there's a legitimate place for you to understand that. And then we'll transition into the kind of the missions component. And so I don't mean to degrade that in any way, but that's where I wanted to end up. So this morning we're going to talk then specifically about giving in the New Testament. Just a very quick review. In the Old Testament, of course, giving, we divided this two ways. And I want to be very clear once again, and it's going to show up in the notes. When we talk about spiritual versus carnal in the Bible, we are not talking about material versus invisible, or invisible versus visible, or intangible versus tangible. In other words, the things that are spiritual are not necessarily invisible things. Things that are spiritual are things that are rightly related to God and His Word. That's the way the Bible uses the word. People can be spiritual. They can be rightly related to God. Their money can be used spiritually, rightly related to God, or can be used carnally, and people can be carnal. So when we're talking about money, all giving, and in fact, I would argue, although I've never really dealt with this, all absence of giving, all use of money, has some spiritual dimension to it, in that the way we spend our money, both what we would give to God, what we would not give to God, what we would use for other things, is some form of declaration about what is important to us, is it not? So it's all some kind of a statement. It all is, I mean, all things are to be done to the glory of God. So we kind of carve out this small portion, and we talk about this amount of money being given to God, and I would be remiss if I ever let any of us think that we cast off a portion to God and all that is done, and then the rest is ours to use as we wish, because that's not true either. But specifically, we're focusing upon the offering portion, all right? So with all of that as the backdrop, in the Old Testament, we learned that on the one hand, giving had a material function. And again, here it is. There's clearly a spiritual element to this, but the use was for material things. We brought, in an agricultural world, you would bring the increase of your soybeans and your corn and your cattle and your hogs to the temple, and I'm not a priest, but I as the priest in that instance would receive that and would live off of that, and then I would take a tithe of that and I would offer it to God. And that would be the way that the system works. So there's clearly a material element to the use of this money. And there's also what I designated as a spiritual function. And maybe a better word would have been a sacrificial function. So everybody gave the tithe. And God collected the tithe kind of indiscriminately. Rich and poor paid it. And then God taught the people that they were to come and bring him offerings. The offerings functioned not in any kind of a material way. Some of those animals were killed and were just simply burned, reduced to ashes. So there was no utility in them from a human standpoint. They were offered up as a sacrifice to God. They represented some spiritual precept or value, but nobody ate them, nobody consumed them, the poor didn't partake of them. They were offered up exclusively to God. Okay? Those are the two kind of governing elements in the Old Testament. The same thing is true in the New Testament. Except in the New Testament, we no longer relate to God spiritually through animal sacrifices and food offerings. In the Old Testament, you demonstrated your faith by offering sacrifices commanded. In other words, how would anybody know that a Jew had faith in God? Somebody would know that a Jew had faith in God because the intention is to do this with a sincere heart. He would offer up the sacrifices that God commanded. So within that Jewish system, he would bring the best of his flock, he would bring animals, he would offer them to God, the priest would kill them, and then use them according to whatever offering it was that is designated. You can read about them in the first seven chapters of Leviticus. And this was the way. In other words, no Old Testament, if I can put it this way, no Old Testament Jew could argue that he was right with God, to use language that we're comfortable with, if he wouldn't participate in the sacrificial system. That was the way he expressed his faith. He obeyed God. But for us, and I'm going to ask you if you would to turn to Hebrews chapter 10, okay? So we want to make sure that we understand that there's a clear distinction here. Our relationship with the law of Moses is not one in which, now that the New Testament has come and now that Christ has died, we wad up the law of Moses and throw it away as insignificant. Right? The law of Moses was written where? Written on what? Two tables of stone. Not by accident. Right? When you get into the book of Corinthians, you realize that's not by accident. Right? Stone. Not living. Not flexible. Not conscious. Just there. Engraven in stone. Okay? What happens? Where is the law now in the New Testament? It is written in our heart. Okay? We didn't bring out our sledgehammers and take the law of Moses and break it to dust because, ooh, yuck, it's the law and it's bad. What was written on a rock for the Jews is written on the heart of a New Testament believer. So, the law counts. How we relate to God, what a reflection of our faith is, has changed. And this is what Paul is, or whoever wrote Hebrews, is arguing. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse number 1. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offered year by year continually make the comers thereunto perfect. For then would they not have ceased to be offered. Right? So if you could offer your very best lamb, and it would have fixed your sin problem, you never would have needed to offer another lamb. And we understand that. We're New Testament people. But isn't it amazing, folks, that the Jews never seemed to grasp that? It never seemed to cross their mind that they kept doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it because it wasn't really accomplishing anything. For then would they not have ceased to be offered, because that the worshippers once purged should have had no more conscience of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is remembrance again made of sins every year. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and of goats should take away sins. Wherefore, when he cometh into the world, this of course is Christ, he saith, sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body hast thou prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou hast no pleasure. And remember, folks, in Isaiah 53, we are told that the sacrifice of Christ was pleasing to God. Okay? God had, when a Jew came and out of a sincere heart offered the sacrifice to God in obedience and faith, God was pleased with his conduct. But the animal didn't cleanse him of sin. That's what's being argued here. Not that God said, offer me a goat, and then God goes, I hate goats. That's not what's being argued at all. Okay? God always has pleasure with the obedience of his people, but the goat isn't going to do anything to take away the sin. So, verse 8, when he said, sacrifice and offering, burnt offerings, offering for sin, thou wouldest not, neither hadst pleasure therein, which are offered by the law. Then said he, lo, I come to do thy will, O God. He taketh away the first, that he may establish the second. They can't coexist. I mean, this would be an excellent point to make if you find yourself witnessing to somebody who is like, say, Roman Catholic, who believes that they're going to work their way to heaven. They can't; those systems can't coexist. Human works and the work of Christ can't coexist as methods of salvation. God took away one to put the other one into place. He didn't let them go up side by side. Verse 10, by the which will we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once. And our Bible says once for all. And the implication is there is one time and it was done. Christ died once. And in that death, he purchased the salvation, or at least the possibility of salvation, for every human being who had ever lived or who ever would live. So, all right. So, I'm going to take my money, okay, and I'm going to offer it to God, and that money is going to have a couple of uses like it had in the Old Testament, but I no longer relate to God by the sacrificial system of animal sacrifices, okay? I demonstrate my faith in God by submitting myself to New Testament language, which doesn't contradict Old Testament language ever. So, a Jew is supposed to understand that the animal sacrifices were a preview of Christ's coming, and we understand that Christ came, and we place our faith in him. So we have faith in God through obedience to God's word, but we're at a different place in the timeline there, but it is always faith. So, okay? So, but even, and we're going to look at this passage a couple of times over the next couple of weeks. Turn, if you would, to Philippians chapter 4. And, of course, the entirety of the book of Philippians is kind of a thank you for your support letter. I mean, it is the inspired version of a missionary letter that you would get, that we get all the time. And by the way, let me make my plug here. If you haven't, make sure you get your email address to Brother Kyle Fisick, and he will put you on the list. And you will, what most of our missionaries these days send out email versions of their letters, and we will get them directly to you. You can keep up what's going on in the lives of our missionaries that way. So put a note in his mailbox with your name and email address, and we'll add you to that list. Philippians chapter 4, verse number 10. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again. And he's talking here about money. Okay, we're gonna see the twin uses of this money, a material function. This Paul has money in his wallet, a gift from the Philippians. But she lacked opportunity, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere, in all things, I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. Notwithstanding, ye have done well that ye did communicate with my affliction. Now ye Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church communicated with me as concerning giving and receiving, but ye only. For even in Thessalonica ye sent once and again unto my necessity. And that just means they brought him two. We don't know how many offerings the church took, but on two different occasions the church brought him money. The church in Thessalonica brought money to Paul. Or the church at Philippi sent money to Paul twice while he was in Thessalonica. And by the way, as far as we know, how long was he in Thessalonica? 3 weeks. Three Sabbath days. So, verse number 17, not because I desire a gift, but I desire fruit that may abound to your account. All right? So, you have all of that going on. Then you have this explanation in verse number 18. But I have all and abound. I am full, having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you. Okay? Now, he's not talking, when you get there to the last part of verse number 18, he's not talking about the fact that Epaphroditus brought him incense. But he is referring to the monetary gift in those kinds of terms. He's not using the word incense, but that would be how we might think of it. An odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. So, in the New Testament, right? I mean, we would probably write a check, but Paul didn't live in that kind of a world. So the church at Philippi was putting coins, gathering coins. Epaphroditus was charged with carrying that money to Paul. And Paul opens the pouch, and there are all of these coins, and his material needs are met. Philippians 4:10. And how does Paul view it? As an offering to God, a sweet-smelling offering to God. Our Christianity, folks, has to exist at more than just a verbal, intentional kind of level. There has to be something tangible to it. The Bible places no confidence in people whose talk is never backed up by words. It just doesn't. And it never gives us the latitude to just go, well, they make all these great statements, right? I mean, Paul will get to that eventually. We won't do it in this, but, you know, Paul will basically say to the Corinthians, it is time to put your money where your mouth is. It is time to put your money where your mouth is. So, and I realize, I really do, folks. I please do not, I mean, for the vast majority of you, it would seem to me, well-pleasing to the Lord. But I mean, I'm just trying to deal with the verses within their context. There is a spiritual element to do this. So the New Testament addresses the use of offerings for material purposes, like paying people like me. And again, we're going to look at this verse in more detail, 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We're going to look at this more specifically next week. But we can kind of map out the principle. First Corinthians chapter 9 and verse number 3. Mine answer to them that do examine me is this: have we not power? Okay, and that means authority, or we would say the right. That's perfectly good use of the word there. Okay? Have we not the right to eat and drink? Have we not power, the right, to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as other apostles, and as the brethren of the Lord in Cephas? So these were men, obviously, their wives are almost never mentioned in the Scripture. But it is apparent that the other apostles had wives, and the wives went with them in their ministries and accompanied them in their travels. And by the way, that the full expectation was that, you know, they would be included in the support that Paul is talking about here. Or I only, verse number 6, and Barnabas, have we not power? Again, the right to forbear working. And what he's talking there is the work that he talks about himself doing, being a tent maker, working with his hands. Who goeth a warfare any time in his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not of the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth the flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Interesting question for the animal rights activists. Doth God take care for oxen? Is God really all that concerned about a cow? Well, here's your answer, verse number 10. Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? In other words, is everything that God said about a cow because God cares about cows, or is he trying to make a point? What's the inspired record? God doesn't care anything about cows. He's trying to make a point. Altogether, Paul says. Saith he it altogether for our sakes. For our sakes, no doubt this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap your carnal things? If others be, and in this instance, it is a reference to that which is material versus that which is immaterial. If others be partaker of this power over you, are not we rather this right? Nevertheless, we have not used this power or this right, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. Do ye not know that they which minister about the holy things live of the things of the temple, and they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar? Even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. And then, of course, in verse number 15, you get to what I think is the real issue to the Corinthian state, is that Paul would not deal with the Corinthians in that way. But I have used none of these things. He had those rights, but he wouldn't use those rights, and that's part of it. But that's another subject. So when we take an offering, and of course we do, and I'm just pointing that out because I know Rick was for a number of years, and maybe some of others of you have been involved in ministries where they collected an offering, but they never took it. They would put some kind of an offering receptacle somewhere at the near the door, the entrance or the exit, and you know, just make mention of it. And it was, I mean, obviously we take an offering, it's a part of the service. When we do that, okay, there is a spiritual component to that. We're giving to God, and I certainly hope that you are consciously aware that you are giving to God and you think of it in those terms, that it is a sacrifice to him, something that he would find pleasing, an acceptable odor. But there's going to be a material use of it. We're going to pay lights and pay me, and we're going to keep up the building. Okay, Paul uses the law as evidence, and he calls this the Lord's doing. Right, the Lord hath ordained. This is it. The word ordained there means something that is appointed or commanded. And again, I'm going to do a little more work on that. I'll just kind of throw this out as a challenge. If you like to study these things, Brother Bill, I know that you know Greek is your native tongue. So, but. I'm going to raise the question next week, do we have to tithe in the New Testament? And I'm going to answer the question with this, yes. So that's going to be where I come down, and I'm going to come down in that on the basis of what's argued in 1 Corinthians 9, 3 through 14. So that doesn't mean you don't have to come next Sunday school, but that's kind of be the gist of where we're going here. Where did the Lord command this? And where did the Lord command this? Right? Verse number 14, even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel live of the gospel. Where did the Lord set this up? Where did the Lord appoint this? Where did the Lord command this? Well, obviously in the Old Testament. But it wasn't just in the Old Testament. And if it was just in the Old Testament, that should be good enough for us. But I think it's also Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, verse number 5, these 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and in any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as ye go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils, freely ye ever see, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves, for the workman is worthy of his meat. So I would argue that with reference to this use of the money, Paul is citing, right, because we're always looking for two or three witnesses, the law and Jesus, as authoritative in this. All right, so there is one of the material uses of New Testament money, just as it was one of the uses of Old Testament money. And we'll talk a little bit about this next week, right? But every believer has to decide for themselves whether it's a big deal or not. That's what Paul is asking. If I've ministered to you spiritual things, is it, he uses the word mega, is it mega to reap your carnal things? Or which one is at the top of the list to the Corinthians was what he was asking. What's more important to you, receiving the ministry of that which is spiritual or hanging on to that which is carnal? So, second use of the money in the New Testament is helping the needy. Right, this was an Old Testament use of the money. Acts chapter 11. Verse number 28, there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be a great dearth throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea, which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. So, this was totally legitimate use in the New Testament, right? And the disciples rose up to the occasion, and offerings were taken, and money was collected and sent to help. Romans chapter 15. Let's start in verse number 25. I have verse number 26 on the screen. But now I go unto Jerusalem to minister unto the saints, for it hath pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. So, right, here's the great Apostle Paul, planter of New Testament churches, writer of New Testament books. And you say, Paul, what's in the immediate, what's on your calendar? He says, well, I'm going to carry some money to Jerusalem, and I'm going to call that a ministry. I'm going to minister to the saints of Jerusalem by taking them some money from Gentiles. So this is not, you know, folks, I mean, and we'll get to this, and you know, I just, you know, as I said, one of the things I want us to do, I want us to think biblically about money. I want us in every endeavor. Folks, should we not, right? God desires truth in the inward part. Should we not, at some level, when we're sorting through this, our giving, our service, whatever it is, should we not, before God, in order to be honest before God, contend with the fact that there is a part of us that is hostile to this? I don't need to find verses in the Bible to give me some kind of a loophole. I am hostile to this. There is a part of me that wants all of my money for me. In fact, folks, if you read the newspaper and look at the news and read the internet and pay attention to what's going on, it would be a much better world if that was all that we were inclined to do. But it is not only my nature to want all of my money, it is my nature to want all of my money and some of yours. And that's the world in which we live. And if we just go, okay, well, here's all these verses, and I don't think that one says that, and I don't think this one says that, and are you really sure they got to do this? Okay, at some point in time, do we ever say to ourselves, you know, I got a nature in me that just kind of doesn't really want to hear any of this. And I've got to factor that in, which is one of the reasons that we're dealing with the Sunday morning series on lust. I mean, right? The problem starts within me. And where God does his work then is within me. And it comes out. So helping the needy. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 6. And really all of 2 Corinthians. By the way, all of these things so far are connected. Right? You have Agabus making the prophecy. You have the churches rising up. One of the things that Paul does as he travels is go around and present the need of the poor saints in Jerusalem. One of the places that he did that was Corinth. And so you have 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. He's talking here about the Thessalonians, primarily. Right? These poor people who were just being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. So, they were under this great affliction. These were not wealthy people. And yet, they were very generous in their gift. Verse number 3, for to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power. Okay, there was a supernatural work going on that accounts for this. They were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. So it is a ministry. Paul viewed it as a ministry. Paul told the Corinthians it was a ministry. The Thessalonians, the model church, thought of it as a ministry. Verse 5, this they did not as we hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord and unto us by the will of God, insomuch that we desire Titus that as he had begun, so he would also finish in you the same grace also. I want to just go ahead and read verse number 7. Therefore, as ye abound in everything, in faith, in utterance, in knowledge, and in all diligence, and in your love to us, see that ye abound in this grace also. So, and I would just, okay, next week we're going to talk about Matthew 23:23, and I would just lay the sentiment of 2 Corinthians 8:7 against the way we sometimes brutalize Matthew 23:23. We'll talk about that. Helping the needy. Okay? And this is this passage, 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, is the one in which Paul says to the Corinthians, it's time to put your money where your mouth is. Right? I mean, here are the very poor, very abused Thessalonians, and God has done this great work, and they have begged us to take their money. I mean, the implication almost seems to be that Paul and Silas and maybe Timothy are going, look, you guys are so poor. You really need to keep this for yourselves. And they're going, no. We want you to take it. And you contrast that with the Corinthians, which was a very affluent assembly of people. Corinth was a big, bustling metropolis. And I'm not saying everybody in the church was rich, but the situation in Corinth was radically different, and they weren't being persecuted, and they weren't being beat up, and they seemed to have some money. And Paul goes, hey, you know, it's time. And Paul was not at all averse to using a little bit of what we would consider to be a guilt trip, right? Those guys are doing it. Why aren't you doing it? And that's really kind of the way he's arguing there in verse number 8. I can't go back into the Old Testament and argue this, I think, is what he's saying. But look at how generous other people have been. What's your excuse? So, yeah. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Let's look there. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse number 17. Charge them that are rich in this world, and I would always make my standard comment right here. Okay? Rich in this world has to be determined by God's standards, not by American standards. Right? We could all go, you know, I don't have Bill Gates money, so I'm not rich in this world, but Bill Gates isn't the standard. The Bible is. So, okay? In other words, I would argue that every American is rich in this world. So, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. So there's a way to think about material wealth. That's verse 17. That they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. There is a way to spend material wealth. You won't spend it in accordance with verse number 18 if you don't think about it rightly in verse number 17. Laying up in store, verse number 19, for themselves a good foundation against the time to come that they may lay hold on eternal life. And he's not talking there about the next recession. He's talking about judgment. Right? He's not talking about buying their way to heaven. He's talking about people who get it. Who get it. That God gives to some people this unique way to minister, and they are to use it wisely for the coming judgment. So
this seems to be an individual initiative here in this passage, whereas the passage before it's like a corporate endeavor to get this together.
Yeah. So,
I guess I'm trying to get an answer.
Yeah, okay. So the point is, and it's a good point, 2 Corinthians 8 seems to be dealing with this issue corporately. In other words, Paul is saying to the entire church, right? Corinthians, you all need to get on board with this and do this. And in 1 Timothy 6, there seems to be more of an individual component to it. And I guess I would say, Glenn, that it should exist at both levels. All right? There are going to be situations that arise that you probably would not know about if the church did not come and go, here's a need, right? We make this recommendation, we're going to take an offering for so-and-so, you know, here's the situation. But there are also going to be times that you may encounter, because not everything gets known to the pulpit, and sometimes God may just put you in a situation where you have a unique opportunity to help individually, and I think it's both. So, I really do think that it's both. So, you know. Yes?
Okay, you're going to encourage us to do more mission work. How are we doing on the giving to poor aspect? Should we be doing more of that? How do you think we're doing there?
How do I think I can speak for almost every pastor in America when I say, when it comes to the matter of giving to the poor, we want to run into the basement, turn off all the lights, close the door, and hope that nobody ever finds us. The Bible is very clear that we should help the poor.
Okay.
What constitutes the poor?
Army that's known for nothing but giving. Are we to skew ourselves in their direction?
No.
Okay.
Because we are clearly... We are clearly governed, right, by, to some extent, by the poor. I mean, the Bible talks about poor, but the poor are always, in the Bible, they are, can I put it this way? Victims, to some extent. Okay? The rich have oppressed them. Their health, you know, and I don't mean that God is brutalizing them, right? Because one of the ways that God is running his world is by giving guy A money and Guy A, B, poverty, so that Guy A can minister to Guy B in the name of God, and Guy B can receive that ministry in the name of God, and God can be glorified by both. If everybody was rich, then you would never be able to do that, and if everybody was poor, you would never be able to do that. One of the great dilemmas we have is we have built an entire world of social assistance. Right? I mean, we have an entire framework, so it becomes kind of easy for us to escape that responsibility, and I don't want to do that. But, you know, what I have recent, and this has just been recent with me in light of something that I've said elsewhere, when I field the calls, and again, there's not a week that goes by that we don't get a call from somebody asking for something, you know. Right.
For us to get it to Timbuktu. So we got poverty all over this world. You may say we got social programs here in the U.S., but they don't extend it.
Right. Well, and I guess that's what. So in that instance, because he's making the good point that the poverty is global more than it is national, what do we do there? So we do this with some of our missionaries, and this is one of the things I would love to be able to see us to fund more. Right. They're on the field. They have a much better sense, like Peru. Okay, we support Tim Whatley, and we support the seminary. And what does that mean? We support the seminary. We give them money, and we let them decide who among their student body really needs the tuition assistance. They're much better suited locally to deal with that than we are. We can provide the funds. Okay, so you know, I think for us, one of the ways that we do that is to have enough money available to our missionaries on the field that we can help, and then we should help in that area. You know, more than giving the money. You know, I mean, if you want to give money to the panhandler on every street corner in Omaha, I mean, that's really your decision. But, you know, I think most of us wonder, are they really poor? You know, but there are truly really poor people in this world. Well, Paul said to the Thessalonians, but, you know, I've already written this to you, and this is a command. If they won't eat, they can't work. I mean, if they won't work, they can't eat. So I think we have to be somewhat discriminate, you know. And like I said, we get calls every week, and there have been times that we have helped. I mean, and, you know, sometimes, you know, I mean, you know.
But you have to remember also that in the Old Testament, they were told to eat the corners of the field.
Right. Right, that's exactly right. Their job was to get it. Now, but there were also a certain segment. You know, there were the very sick and the very elderly, and obviously they needed greater attentiveness and care. I hope that we do that better. But, you know, I think biblically able-bodied people, you know, the expectation is that they would work. And I think the expectation on us is that this is just a challenge to me, Tony, to maintain a compassionate spirit without being a sucker for every hard luck story, right? And I mean, you know, yes.
When you were at Diana, of course, everybody there thought we're Americans coming to Diana to get money. And if we don't have money, we have a source of a way to get it.
Yes.
We had people at our meetings all the time. You need money, you need money.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's what I say. You know, I mean, I don't want to be hard about this, but when people call and ask anymore, you know, I go, are you calling me from a landline or a smartphone?
But what we ended up doing was, instead of just sending out money, if it was a guy, he would offer up work for them.
Right.
If it was a woman, I would offer up work that you work alongside me. And if you're telling me to pick if they were truly poor or not, if they said, I'm not time for that, okay, you're not poor.
Right. Well, again, they were the same thing. You know, are they willing to participate? We've done that. I mean, we did that building that building out there in the back. We had a guy that wanted some money. We said, well, will you work? And he came out. I mean, it was January. He spent a day, and he didn't have all the clothing. Well,
but you're in Omaha, that's what I'm talking about. But if you said, you know what, I want a job for you, I've got some work for you that you can do.
Well, and I'm just, you know, most of the calls that we get come, of course, through the church office, and we tend to handle them that way. You know, you don't ever want to be heartless. You know, I always start, you know, the first question I always ask people is, have you talked to your pastor? Right? Because I'm going to assume that if you had a legitimate financial need, you, Westwood Heights people, if you had a legitimate financial need, I would hope that you would let us in on it somehow. Right? We do have, you know, and now I'm really off track and I'm running out of time. But I would just point out to you folks that pride, this terrible sin that has so many forms, right? Pride can take the form of, I'm not giving anybody any of my money. But pride can also take the form of, I'm not asking anybody for money. Okay? So if somebody has a legitimate need, I would hope that if you had a legitimate need, you would make that need known to us. Right? That we would have an opportunity to legitimately minister to you in that need. And I know that I could say with confidence, we would do that in that situation. I mean, the evidence is there. So, you know, I would start with, you know, if you talk to your pastor, well, you know, I mean, then it goes into, you know, basically, it doesn't take very long to figure out that there are some people, they just kind of go through the phone book or the Google and they just start calling, seeing who will give them cash. Okay, let me just make sure. Last thing here, and we'll talk about this next week. One of the other functional uses of New Testament money is missions, advancing the gospel. Romans 15, Philippians is a thank you for your missionary support. The entire book of Romans is, hi, my name is Paul. I wish you would undertake supporting me in this great endeavor of preaching the gospel. That's where he begins. That's where he ends. In between is the great doctrine of salvation. And the word expression that he uses there, brought on my way in Romans 15:24, it has the idea of helping somebody accomplish their goal. Philippians 4, we've already dealt with. 3 John 1, we'll look at that in a couple of weeks when we do missions, because it's now 9 minutes to 11, which means church is going to start late. And so thanks always for your help and participation. Questions, comments, you can talk to me privately, write notes to me in my box, put them in my mailbox,